For centuries, contracting tuberculosis was a death sentence. In the early part of the 20th century, TB was sweeping the country, and sanatoriums were founded to keep the disease from spreading and to offer hope of a cure. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. In 1908, Oakdale Sanatorium was founded in Johnson County. The sanatorium sat on a large farm and became an isolated, self-sustaining community for the sick and those who cared for them. Betty Lucina was an occupational therapist who lived and worked at Oakdale, and Chuck Dayton, a pharmacist at the University of Iowa, also worked at the sanatorium. We'll talk about what life there was like and take a look at the history of TB in the state. Later this hour, Dr. Doug Hornick of the University of Iowa Hospital and Clinics will be here to help us understand tuberculosis and the danger the disease still poses today. Join our conversation after the news. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. At the turn of the 20th century, tuberculosis was spreading rapidly across the United States. To stem the spread of what was called the White Plague, sanatoriums were created to isolate and treat the sick. In 1908, the state of Iowa founded Oakdale Sanatorium in Johnson County. The sanatorium sat on a large farm in what is now Coralville and became an isolated, self-sustaining community for the sick and for those who cared for them. Oakdale Hall is scheduled to be demolished this month, which got us thinking about the history of this unusual institution and the history of tuberculosis in the state. My guests today are Betty Lucina. She was an occupational therapist who lived and worked at Oakdale, and Chuck Dayton, a clinical pharmacy specialist at the University of Iowa, who also worked at the sanatorium. And we'd like to hear from you as well. Do you have family stories about tuberculosis? Did you have a family member in the past who went to the sanatorium or to a similar institution somewhere? You can join our conversation and share your stories with us at 866-780-9100. You can tweet us at IPRTalk. You can also send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. And Betty, I want to start with you. You started working at the sanatorium in 1952?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. What was the environment there like when you arrived?
Well, I had been out there for the two previous months to do part of my clinical training, and so I'd gotten to know what it was like and a lot of the patients and everything. So when they asked me to stay on the staff, I was quite willing to do that. It was a very friendly, warm atmosphere. You, of course, were very, very well liked by the patients, and that always made you feel good when you were in that situation.
Do you have an idea of how many patients were there when you started?
I believe there would have been somewhere around 400.
Wow. So it was
a very large
institution. Mm-hmm.
And then, of course, all the people that were employed there were living there also.
And what was your job?
Well, I was an occupational therapist, and an occupational therapist for a patient like that was not so much to give them exercises for their upper extremities unless they'd had surgery, which required you to help their muscles to recover. But it was mostly just trying to keep the people happy about their environment and to give them something to do and something else to think about other than their disease.
Now, we're going to talk more about treatments for tuberculosis with Chuck in just a moment. But when you first started, did a lot of the patients actually get better and get to leave the sanatorium?
When I first started, there were still quite a few of them that you knew were never, ever going to leave. And that, of course, was the sad part of the job, was to try to keep them happy when you knew they were there for the long haul until they probably would die.
Wow.
And they were away from their families, of course, and it was very sad.
When you started, were you afraid at all that you would get tuberculosis?
Not really. We were well protected. We wore masks, gowns, were very, very careful. That's the first thing they taught you was to wash your hands every time you went by something, any sort of facility where you could wash them. And you just learned to be careful, and they also taught the patients to be very careful.
Okay. They did not spread it to
mm-hmm.
others.
Mm-hmm.
Well, Chuck, I want to talk to you, and you worked at the sanatorium. You also went on to have an illustrious career in pharmacy and specialize in pulmonary diseases. When you arrived at the sanatorium in 1974, Were there still patients there?
About 10% of what Betty just reported. It was in the high 40s, people who were actively being treated for tuberculosis at that time, yes.
That seems astonishing that still in 1974 there would be people in a sanatorium as opposed to being treated in another way.
Well, that was very near the end of the sanatorium era, and I came in sort of the middle of the picture, I guess you might say, in movie terms, of treatment of tuberculosis. A lot had happened before, but yet there was still more developments to come after that.
Well, let's talk about the early treatment for tuberculosis, because as I said, the sanatorium was founded in 1908, and this was a movement across the nation and actually across the world, because tuberculosis had been plaguing people for centuries, and it had been considered to be a death sentence for centuries. But at the point that the sanatorium was founded, there was an understanding that sometimes with fresh air and bed rest and good care, that people could actually get better. Is that all we had to offer at first?
That's right. The sanatorium era actually came into existence after a fellow by the name of Koch discovered the tubercle bacillus, which people finally recognize as the causative agent for tuberculosis. And once people knew that, isolation of patients, keeping them apart from the rest of society, became the norm. And most of the time, these sanatoria were in places where the air was fresh, lots of pine trees and sunshine, and that was essentially the drug therapy of the early part of the century. It was sunshine, pine trees, and bed rest.
How successful was that kind of treatment?
Well, I don't have the exact numbers, but if you're not treating the causative agent of the disease, you're relying entirely on the body's own defense mechanisms. And my suspicion is there were some people with very good defense mechanisms that fought off the disease and went on to lead fairly normal lives, and at the other end of the spectrum, people who were not so fortunate. So it probably had more to do with the individual person than it did with the environment that was being provided.
There were attempts to cure tuberculosis in a number of ways. One of them was actually a surgical attempt cure TB. Can you tell me about that?
Some people thought that since the TB bacillus relied on air to grow, if you cut off the air, then you would cut off the ability of the disease to progress. And people were actually given intentional pneumothoraces, or their lung was punctured so it would actually deflate. And this would hopefully kill off some of the bacteria and allow the better lung to function.
That sounds horrible. Did it work?
To some extent, yes. There were people who had these, I believe the term was thoracoplasty, is that right, Betty?
Yes.
Had these thoracoplasty procedures that were actually employees at Oakdale when I started, that had been done 10, 20 years prior to that, that were getting along pretty well, actually.
Betty, you said you knew people who had had this surgery. Could you tell if they'd had the surgery?
Oh, yes. We had several of our people there who had thoracoplasties, and the reason you could tell they had was the fact that the one half of their chest would be sunken in, which gave them an off-kilter walk because one shoulder would be much higher than the other. And even though we had probably tried to give them exercises to build up those muscles, still with that having been done to them, they looked quite deformed. Oh. But at least they were living. That
right.
was the main thing.
Right. Antibiotics began to really come about in the 1940s. How effective were those early antibiotics for tuberculosis?
Well, that's an interesting story. 1945 was the beginning of the use of the drug streptomycin. And streptomycin was incredibly effective against the tubercle bacillus, and people got better very quickly when they started getting streptomycin injections. However, it became apparent early on that this wasn't going to work by itself, that relapses occurred in almost every instance. People got very, very much better, and they relapsed shortly with drug-resistant or streptomycin-resistant bacteria.
Streptomycin did have strong side effects, didn't it, as well?
Yeah, it sure did. Very limited amounts could be given before the toxicities would become apparent in the nervous system and so forth.
It probably felt like almost the magic bullet, but not quite.
That's right. Then in 1950, the British Medical Research Council found that adding another drug to streptomycin, a drug called PAS, or para-aminosalicylic acid, was added to streptomycin, and that's the first time that actual results of cures of tuberculosis were sustained. PAS had its own problems. Betty can probably tell a little bit about this too, but Dr. John Kasich, who was the medical director at Oakdale, was a wonderful person to regale us of tales of the past. And he would tell stories that he had heard from people at Oakdale when they began their PAS treatment. It had severe effects on the gastric system. People became quite sick when they took it. And in the springtime, when the snow melted, when you looked out the window, you'd see lots of brown spots out on the lawn. And sure enough, it was documented that the bedposts were full of PAS and also the ground beneath the windows of the rooms at Oakdale were brown with where PAS had been thrown out the window. So patient compliance was not stellar with that drug.
It was so unpleasant that even if it represented a cure, maybe it wasn't worth it to give it a try. Betty, as these developments, you witnessed a lot of changes. What was that like to be present treating these patients while these drugs were being developed?
Well, it was encouraging. We felt that maybe things were progressing. And we had a few problems. I was thinking about streptomycin. One of the side effects of it was that it bothered their hearing. Mm-hmm. Do you remember how a lot of our patients, their tuberculosis was getting better, but they couldn't hear anymore. So it was... That would be kind of a bad thing, too. But still, they did feel better because of their tuberculosis being better. And I was just happy to be there and be trying to help the people to get over their feeling bad about being there. And we had to help with giving them parties. And you just did everything you possibly could think of to help them feel better.
Well, I want to talk more about life at Oakdale Sanatorium when we get back from a break. We're going to take a short break here, and we're also going to continue to talk about the history of tuberculosis. And we'd love to have you join the conversation as well. If you have a family story about a family member in the past who suffered from tuberculosis, maybe they actually went to Oakdale Sanatorium, or maybe they were treated in another way. We'd love to hear your stories. 866-780-9100. You can tweet us at IPR Talk. You can also send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. My guests today are Betty Lucina, an occupational therapist who worked at the sanatorium, and Chuck Dayton, a pharmacist at the University of Iowa. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. Today we're talking about the history of tuberculosis in the state of Iowa and across the nation. In 1908, the state of Iowa founded Oakdale Sanatorium in Johnson County, and that's where most of the patients who had tuberculosis in the state went at the beginning. They went there for rest and fresh air. That was the only treatment for tuberculosis around the turn of the 20th century. But we've been talking about how treatments developed over time. Oakdale Hall is just about to be torn down, so we thought this was a good time to take a look back at the history. Betty Lucina was an occupational therapist who lived and worked at Oakdale. And Chuck Dayton is a retired clinical pharmacy specialist from the University of Iowa. He also worked at the sanatorium in the 1970s. And Chuck, we sort of started on the path of the story of treatment of tuberculosis, and we took a side path there. So let's return to that. We were talking about the developments of streptomycin and another drug that would work together with streptomycin, but that was not the magic bullet people were looking for.
The real breakthrough in the treatment of tuberculosis occurred in 1952 with the marketing of a drug called isoniazid, which we all abbreviated as INH. And isoniazid was just an excellent drug against the tubercle bacillus, it worked really well. When combined with streptomycin and PAS, 10 years later, in 1962, the definitive studies showed that these three drugs used together for 2 years, so that's a long time. But in the whole world of bacteria, mycobacteria divide and multiply very, very slowly. Compared to most bacteria, it's in a day or more. Most bacteria are a matter of minutes in their dividing time. So it took 24 months of three drugs to get cure rates above 90%, and that would be what you have been calling a magic bullet, I guess. That would be the start of the modern era of tuberculosis chemotherapy.
2 full years, though.
Yes, yes. In 1962, that was really the only evidence. The other real breakthrough and the beginning of the final demise of sanatoria was in 1966, when some researchers showed that hospital treatment and home treatment, if the patients took their medicine, which is a big caveat, the results were the same. So that was the first time people said, well, why are we keeping people in the hospital if we can do the same thing at home?
Was there, you know, originally one of the reasons for the sanatoriums was to control the spread of the disease. Once this more treatable, was there less concern about spreading the disease among family members?
There was, because the drug isoniazid had a very rapid and thorough killing of millions of TB organisms within the first 2 weeks to a month of treatment. And people became much less infectious in a very short time. And this is why it was such a breakthrough, because it did render the disease less contagious.
In the beginning part of our conversation today, though, we talked about the fact that you got to the sanatorium in 1974, and there were still almost 50 people there. Why were there still people at the sanatorium if this breakthrough had been made in the early 60s?
Well, there are a number of reasons for that. One is people weren't comfortable about sending people back to families with small children, families who had relatives that were immunocompromised for some reason, were on drugs that made them more susceptible to catching tuberculosis. And in some cases, people just were not reliant enough to take their medicine. So that was in the 70s sort of the core population of Oakdale Hospital, which I don't think even was called a sanatorium by then. It was the chest unit of the University of Iowa hospitals at that time.
Now, we're going to talk about tuberculosis in the modern era in a few minutes and
yes.
talk about the very present dangers that still exist. But in my lifetime, TB has not been something that we worried about. Was there a point where people thought, we're going to get rid of this disease? It's going to disappear completely.
Well, absolutely. We, in the 60s and 70s, more and more effective chemotherapy, shorter durations. It eventually worked down to 6 months of therapy given two times a week. And what that did was it enabled the public health system in Iowa, which is excellent, by the way. The Iowa public health system would monitor, each county had its own public health nurses, and would monitor the medicines being given to people twice weekly outside of the hospital setting. And that's really, by 1980, which turned the tide to having almost no one having to be hospitalized for tuberculosis.
Carla sent us an email from Waterloo. She says, thank you for this discussion. I'm 56 years old, and my paternal grandfather died of TB in 1944. One of my uncles and one of my cousins on the same side of the family both had TB and spent some time in the sanatorium. And this is a topic that's been of great interest to my family throughout the years. And I do want to get back to what life was really like at the sanatorium, Betty, in a moment. But we also have Bobby on the line from Iowa City. Hello, Bobby.
Hello.
Hi there. What would you like to talk about?
Well, this is a very interesting trip down memory lane for me, because I told your screener that I was a student nurse, and it was either in probably 1961 that we had to do a TB hospital rotation. And our hospital, my base hospital, was in Evansville, Indiana, Daughter Charity Hospital. We had to go to Indianapolis, and this place was out in the country. It was a ramshackle old place. God only knows when it was built. And I would say that 99% of our patients that we had at the time had absolutely nowhere else to go. And the drug that was used at that time still was streptomycin, but the side effects are horrendous. And INH, and there was another drug that began with an R, like ranitidine or rifampin or something like that. I don't remember the name.
Rifampin.
There you go. These people had to have 3 negative TB tests. And interestingly, most of these folks actually did not have TB, as we later learned. They had histoplasmosis, which I understand is a bird-borne disease, and how they picked it up, I don't know. But they really were not TB patients. But that sanatorium closed not too long. I think our class was the last to have to endure this place. I told your screener it didn't even.
It didn't even. I'm sorry. What?
It's gone.
Oh, I
think it was like something out of the Dark Ages. I mean, when it got dark at night, it was dark.
Oh,
it
wow.
It was a long, difficult 6 weeks, and as your first speaker said, we took every precaution. We had to have TB skin tests before and after we left, and then so many, they were spaced out, you know, for so many months after. And one of my group did convert, and she had to be on INH for like a year or so as a precautionary measure. So
that must have been terrifying.
It was not a pleasant place to be. Plus, we were truly, truly isolated. There was absolutely nowhere to go to get rid of it or away from this. And we also had patients who were actual TB patients who had TB not only of the lung but of the kidney and bone. So those were truly tragic cases.
Well, Bobby, thank you so much for sharing your story today.
Well, thank you for letting me.
Thanks a lot. And Betty, I want to go back to Oakdale Sanatorium and talk about what it was like. You make it sound like a much more pleasant place than the sanatorium that Bobby went to in Indiana. But you actually lived there, and you met your husband there.
Yes.
It was a real community. What
was
it like?
We had our own farm, our own dairy, pasteurizing plant. I think our own butcher shop. That food would be brought in huge bulks, and it would be processed out there. And our own post office, everything was, it was just like a community. And so that you felt at home there, and there was really not a lot of need to leave. However, we being only around 8 miles from Iowa City, we in our younger days, of course, always went back and forth to Iowa City, but I think there were a lot of people who lived out there who did not travel very far from Oakdale.
Excuse me. That reminds me of something. One of my other passions in my off time is trains and railroading.
Oh, yes.
And there are pictures of the Crandic Railroad, the car passing through Oakdale. And there was a stop at the Oakdale Sanatorium, but the conductors would hand out handkerchiefs to the passengers so they could put them over their face during the stop at Oakdale.
Wow. Well, and I was just going to ask you, Betty, when you told people that you worked at the sanatorium, was there any kind of a stigma to that? Were people nervous being around you?
I did not notice that they were. Perhaps they were, but they didn't really, you know, convey that to me.
People didn't get their hankies out when you told them.
No, they didn't.
You also had children there. And, you know, as a mother, was that frightening for you to think that your kids were going to be around this disease all the time?
Yes, we did not live in the hospital, however. We lived in a little house. It was probably, I would say, around 2 blocks from across campus from the hospital. So that they did not ever really go over there. And we were both very careful, of course, to not ever bring anything back to the house that would probably make our children get it. And with it being an airborne disease, it was not going to be clinging to your clothes. You almost had to have one of them cough in your face in order for you to get
right.
it. So,
but you did have to have x-rays every 6 months
just
to make sure.
Yes, we had x-rays every 6 months, and I think we had a tuberculin every year, as I recall. And we also had chest exams every 6 months just to make sure nothing was going on.
She's talking about a TB skin test, which is still used today for screening for people who might have been exposed to tuberculosis.
Okay, and that's mm-hmm. it's a common test that a lot of people mm-hmm. need to take. I believe when you were talking to our researcher earlier, you mentioned that your husband would take an interesting precaution.
Yes.
What did he do to try to not get TB?
When he first went out there, his office was at one end of the hospital, and the place to eat was at the other end of the hospital and on the second floor. And he told me that when he first got there, he would hold his breath from the time he left the office until he got all the way to the dining room, because he just didn't want to breathe in any of those TB germs.
He got over that.
Yes, though. He did, yes.
But you mentioned that your children never went over to the hospital, so they weren't really at risk. But you did have a health scare with your son.
Yes, we did. When my daughter was probably about 6 and our son about 8, they had a persistent cough in the spring, and our pediatrician could not really pinpoint what it was, and so he suggested that they have a chest x-ray. They did, and they could see a spot on their lung. And, of course, that just really threw me into a panic, because I thought, oh, dear, I brought it home to them.
Right.
So they said, well, the only way to really find out what it is to give them a TB skin test and also a histoplasmosis skin test. And the histo skin test came out positive and the TB negative. So we knew it was just histo, and that is something that's a little bit more self-curing, that you didn't really have to have any treatment for it.
Well, and Chuck Bobby mentioned histoplasmosis.
Yes.
Was there a lot of confusion about tuberculosis and histoplasmosis?
There was in the early days. It was difficult to distinguish because the chest x-rays of people with histoplasmosis and tuberculosis oftentimes looked the same. Cavitary lesions, as we call them, in the lung. And we live in the broad Mississippi River Valley in the Midwest, and including your caller from Indianapolis. And histoplasmosis is something that all of us are exposed to, and all of us could get. And there was an old saw back in the early days: if you came to a sanatorium and you didn't have tuberculosis, but you had histo, you would soon have tuberculosis. So,
oh, wow.
Yeah, it was difficult to distinguish those.
Judith is on the line from Dubuque. Hello, Judith.
Hi. Hi.
Hi.
I just wanted to share my mother's story. She was born in 1908 and decided to become a nurse. And she, excuse me, she moved from Montana to Minneapolis to get her nurse's training at Trinity Hospital in Minneapolis. And there, they worked very, very hard. All those young nurses were just, they were just cruelly used. And she, along the line, was diagnosed with tuberculosis. And the doctor did just a sort of a duck kind of thing. He said, well, we're going to put you in a sanitarium where you only do light work, and you will graduate at the right time. And so my mother was in a sanitarium, and she didn't talk about it very much, but eventually she was diagnosed being okay. But the doctor said, now you have to be very careful. Meanwhile, my mother was in love with my dad, who was training to become a pastor in Minneapolis. And so they got married, but the doctor said, you mustn't have children right away. You've got to build up your strength. So she waited, and he gave her a diaphragm, which was practically unheard of in the 1930s. She was married in 1931. And she postponed childbirth for 7 years.
Wow.
And so she didn't have any relapses, and she didn't have terrible trauma with the diagnosis. But anyway, that's her story.
Well, Judith, thank you so much for sharing with us today.
Yeah, her name is Helen Hegland Simonson, my mother.
Great. Thank you so much.
You're welcome. Bye-bye.
And we are going to talk about tuberculosis in modern times and the very real dangers that TB causes today in just a moment. Dr. Doug Hornick is going to be joining us in a moment, but I need to say goodbye to Betty. Thank you so much for joining us today and for sharing your memories.
Thank you.
Betty Lucina was an occupational therapist who lived and worked at Oakdale Sanatorium for 16 years, starting in 1952. And Chuck Dayton, thank you so much for your time today.
Yes, thank you.
Chuck Dayton is a retired clinical pharmacy specialist from the University of Iowa. He specialized in pulmonary diseases. If you'd like to share your stories about tuberculosis in your family, you can still join our conversation. Or if you have questions about the disease today, again, that's what we'll be talking about next. You're welcome to join us with your questions at 866-780-9100. You can tweet us at IPR Talk or send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. This is Talk of Iowa. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe, and today we're talking about tuberculosis. We've been exploring the history of the disease and the history of treatments of the disease. We were talking about Oakdale Sanatorium in Johnson County that was founded in 1908, but now we're going to move into modern times. And joining me is Dr. Doug Hornick. He's a pulmonary specialist and professor at the University of Iowa, the resident expert on tuberculosis. Hello, Dr. Hornick.
Hi, Charity. It's nice to be here. Thank you.
Thank you so much for joining us. And we were talking a few minutes ago. Chuck Dayton was telling us about all of the advances in treatment for tuberculosis. And there must have been a time when people thought that tuberculosis was a thing of the past, but it is not. Why is it still with us?
Well, tuberculosis is a rather unique pathogen in that it's probably designed from very early ages that human beings were walking on this planet to live within our bodies. So because of that, I think it's going to be very difficult to ever eradicate it completely, especially when you think that one-third of the world's population is still infected with tuberculosis.
One-third?
That's correct. Over 2 billion people are still infected with tuberculosis. And that's mainly in other parts of the world. The United States, the problem is not that big. But if you think of third world countries in particular, Southeast Asia, Central Africa, India, China, Eastern Europe, Russia, and South America, they're all very heavily infected with tuberculosis. So it's a worldwide problem, and since we move around very easily from place to place in this world today, it's going to continue to be, and it's so contagious, it's going to continue to be with us.
Now, when you say infected, there are people who can carry TB without actively showing the symptoms. Are you talking about those people as well, or are you just talking about people who actively have the disease?
Yeah, that's a very good question. I actually wanted to clarify that after listening to Chuck and the others talk. So I would put it in this way. There are two major forms of tuberculosis: active disease, which is the one that's feared by everybody, and the one where the person is ill, losing weight, coughing, and has those changes on the chest X-ray that Chuck was talking about earlier. That actually represents sort of the tip of the iceberg, if you will, if you look at all people with tuberculosis. So about 5% of patients with tuberculosis or persons with tuberculosis will have the active form of the disease, whereas 90 to 95% have what's called latent tuberculosis, where they're infected but do not have symptoms. Those people cannot transmit the disease, but they are sort of the reservoir from which active disease can develop later. So say a person is infected and they develop HIV, that destroys the immune system that controls tuberculosis, and then they can develop active tuberculosis, and then once they're active, they can then spread it to others. So if it's a mother or a father in a family in Africa, then the children become infected, and so on.
Well, I want to talk more about the relationship of tuberculosis with HIV, because the spread of HIV/AIDS seems to be very related to an increase in the problem of people having tuberculosis.
That's correct. HIV is a disease that affects your immune system, of course, and it affects the type of immunity that's required to keep tuberculosis and diseases like tuberculosis, but in particular tuberculosis, in check. And therefore, patients or places where HIV is prevalent, usually tuberculosis goes hand in hand because, like I mentioned before, if you look at the number of people infected with tuberculosis even before there was HIV in the world, and then you mix in HIV, then you it's like pouring gasoline on the fire because now those people who are infected, not active, not symptomatic, get HIV, they then become active, and then they can spread the disease elsewhere. So actually, if you look at this country, when HIV became apparent and rampant in the 1980s, along with that came a resurgence in tuberculosis, and it wasn't until we controlled the HIV epidemic more effectively along with tuberculosis that we got it back into control in the late 90s.
William is on the line from Davenport with a question. Hello, William.
Yes.
Hi, what's your question?
Yes, my father's brothers and sisters were susceptible to TB. They lived in the same household for a number of years. My dad's siblings never developed the disease. I'm just curious if that's an unusual phenomenon.
Actually, that's not an unusual phenomenon. It sort of brings to bear what I said earlier, how only a small percentage, 5 to 10% of anybody that's infected with tuberculosis, develops the active disease, and that's not considering HIV. So if you take people who have an intact immune system, they can usually contain the disease, more often than not contain the disease, and it stays latent within their system, waiting for an opportunity for the rest of their life. Luckily, those opportunities are few and far between. So we usually tell people that there's a less than 5% chance for the rest of their life that they'll develop active tuberculosis, even though they've become infected. The chance that they develop active disease is during the time, the highest chance to develop active disease is during that time of exposure. So those folks that were living in the household that you described would be most likely to develop active disease within that time that they were living there if their immune system was overwhelmed. If we start somebody on treatment, then everybody in that household becomes much less likely to develop active disease, or the contagion goes almost to zero. And that explains why you can have exposure but not the development of active disease. And that probably, the development of active disease and close household exposure is about at a rate of, say, 15 to 20% will develop active disease or become, I'm sorry, I should say will develop infection even, and a few of those will develop active disease in a close household context. So it requires prolonged exposure, and not everybody will get sick, and oftentimes our immune system can contain it and prevent it.
William, thank you so much for your call. And that explains something about the history of the disease, which is that before the turn of the century, before the turn of the 20th century, people believed that tuberculosis, or what was commonly called consumption, sprang up in individuals just as a matter of course. It didn't have spontaneously.
Yeah.
It didn't have anything to do with being transmitted from one person to another.
Well, the other interesting thing is if you look, the downturn in the epidemic had already started in the late 1800s and the early 1900s and on into the 1950s when we started to develop drugs. You heard about streptomycin and then PAS and INH. The epidemic was already decreasing rapidly, and what the theory is that we, those that grew up, or you know, the multiple generations through that time, developed a sort of natural resistance to the disease, and fewer people were developing the TB despite the fact that they had constant exposure. And that's very difficult to measure. Even today, we don't understand what that process is. But, for example, when white people moved to this country, the Native Americans that were here already were extremely susceptible to tuberculosis. And you've probably heard stories, people have heard stories of how TB virtually wiped out some tribes in some parts of this country because they had never seen that bug before the white people brought it to this country. And they were sort of what would happen if you don't have that sort of natural immunity that comes from generations of exposure.
When TB made its resurgence along with the HIV epidemic, what kinds of changes took place in how TB was treated and tested for to try to get it under control?
Well, actually, it was nothing high-tech. It was during the 1970s, because the rates of tuberculosis were dropping so rapidly in this country, all the public health and the public health infrastructure, the sanitaria, were all closing. People who had been treating tuberculosis for years were retiring, so we really didn't have the kind of structure in place to isolate and manage these people when we started to recognize the resurgence. And in fact, it was just getting back into place, proper isolation, starting patients on treatment early with suspicion, and having a high index of suspicion for active tuberculosis in those HIV patients that really brought the epidemic back into control. And it wasn't development of new treatments. It was even before we had pretty effective treatment for HIV that we had brought the tuberculosis outbreak associated with HIV under control. And that is really the problem in other parts of the world where it's still rampant. They just don't have the resources to do the kinds of things that are necessary, the basic things for isolation and starting patients on these drugs that they need. And the drugs are very expensive, and physicians that know how to treat tuberculosis are few and far between. So we have a persisting problem.
Back when I was in college, I remember that all of the exchange students and people from other countries that I went to school with had to be tested for TB. Was that a change that went into place with the resurgence, that people just got tested more often, particularly if they came from somewhere else?
Yes, I think we recognized that we had to clamp down. And in fact, the resurgence was tracked to foreign-born individuals coming here with tuberculosis and then getting mixed up with the HIV population. So, yes, indeed, we recognize that the rates of tuberculosis are much higher in other parts of the world. So we screen those people for evidence of latent tuberculosis, which is a skin test. And nowadays there's a blood test for that. But back in the 1980s and 90s, we started screening everybody, students here that came from parts of the world where TB was prevalent. And if they had a positive skin test, we treated them. And you treat them not the same as active TB. We treat them with one drug, but they have to take it for 9 months, INH. And that reduces the chance of them developing active tuberculosis while they're here pretty much almost to nil.
I was going to ask you about that, what kinds of treatments might be available for people who carry the disease but don't have an active form of the disease. It seems like taking a drug for 9 months is a pretty...
Yeah.
A big thing to ask of a person.
It is a big thing to ask, but if you look at the cost to an individual of developing active tuberculosis and to the community, I think the cost balances out in favor of treating. And so we do require people to take 9 months of INH, and the reason for that is the bug is is sort of walled off within our immune system in the body, and it's not clear exactly what's going on, but we know if we shorten the treatment to the people who have done those studies, 3 months, 6 months, 3 months definitely doesn't make enough of a difference. 6 months is almost and probably good enough, and 9 months is definitely enough when you look at people that go on to develop active tuberculosis after they've received those various treatments.
With so much TB around the world, has there been a growth in drug-resistant strains of the disease?
Yes, there has. And that is an emerging problem that could hearken the return of widespread use of containment in places like sanatoria once again. In fact, we have several of those still in operation in this country to manage just that situation, multiple drug-resistant tuberculosis and extremely or extensively drug-resistant tuberculosis. That the latter, extensively drug-resistant tuberculosis, has been in the news a little bit more lately, mainly because of some high-profile outbreaks in Africa, particularly South Africa, KwaZulu-Natal province in South Africa. There's a very there's been a very big problem with extensively drug-resistant tuberculosis. There are no drugs to treat that disease. The only thing you can do is keep those individuals contained and hope to surgically remove the parts of the lung that are infected, and leaving enough low enough levels of residual disease that perhaps would respond to very complex drug treatment regimens. But as we learned in the pre-antibiotic era, you know, tuberculosis is, even active disease, is not uniformly deadly or more lethal. About half the people that get active tuberculosis actually recover completely. So that's no different when you're talking about extensively drug-resistant tuberculosis. But it takes a long time, takes months, years, and you have to keep those people from getting out into the community where they can expose other people. So that's how they're managing it, and as best they can, where they have the resources in parts of the world where this is a problem. Luckily, right now, what we know is at the worst places, it still represents 10% of the tuberculosis isolates. But the problem with that statistic is that the resources to even gather those statistics and to either measure and to even measure drug resistance in tuberculosis is not even present in many of the places where tuberculosis is overwhelming in its extent of disease.
So in some ways that could set us back a century.
That's right. And in the United States, we have some places where we can put or contain these individuals. There's San Antonio, Texas, just finished a brand new hospital devoted to this because they have a big problem with immigrants from, you know, South America, Central America, where there are parts where they end up in Texas and other parts of this country with active tuberculosis is extremely resistant, and so they can contain and treat them there.
Dr. Hornick, thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you.
Dr. Doug Hornick is a pulmonary specialist and professor at the University of Iowa. This is Talk of Iowa. Talk of Iowa is produced by Dennis Reitz and Mitchell Schmidt. Our executive producer is Jeff Schmidt. Podcasting and on-demand audio of the show are available at iowapublicradio.org. You can send us email anytime. You can give us suggestions for things you'd like to hear on the show or respond to things you have heard at talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. Coming up tomorrow, I'll talk with Ryan Romerman, executive director of the Iowa Pride Network, about his recent award as one of USA Television's Characters Unite recipients for 2010. This is Talk of Iowa.